So I got another point here that it kind of came from your last statement about being isolated, Sarah. And I don't really know which way to go with this, but I'm going to say it and we can take it from wherever it leads us. But I grew up in a very, I won't say segregated, but I guess it is segregated. You know, I grew up in Atlanta. The majority of the communities I lived in were all Black. You know, I think I might have lived in 3 or 4 different communities growing up. And with the exception of one, there were no white people on my street. Actually, let me take that back, too. In one neighborhood, our next door neighbor was a white family. Everybody else on the street was Black. The next neighborhood we lived in was all Black. The next neighborhood we lived in was all Black. The final neighborhood we moved to was mixed. It was, you know, 50-50-ish. School systems I grew up in. Elementary school, all Black. Middle school, mixed. High school. My high school was about 1,500 students. And I believe we had 12 white students in 1 year. And half of them left after the first couple of weeks of school. I think we might have had 6 or 7 by the end of the year. So all that said to say that the majority of my life was pretty much centered around people of color, Black people, Mexicans, Vietnamese. That was it. There were very few white people in my world, with the exception that I played baseball from Little League on up. That was probably my most real experience with white people, was playing baseball, because, you know, there's not a lot of Black people playing baseball. But I did. That was my kind of entryway to see, you know, because there were some team members who I'd go to their house after a game, or we'd go out to eat after the practice, or, you know, we'd even hang out sometimes on the weekend because we knew each other. And as you said, Sarah, about dominant culture, I saw things. I was like, whoa, why are they doing that? Like, what's going on over here? You know, sure. So to me, it was all strange, because my whole life was around minority Black people of color. And then I come into these white households. I'm like, what is it? What's going on? What is that? You know? And I'm sure if they had been in my neighborhood, they would have felt strangely out of place also. So, you know, it's a lot of it is a cultural difference, but if you never see the other culture, you assume that this is how the world is. As you said, this is, no, it's not. That's how your people in your community do things.
Absolutely.
So let's go a little further down the road.
Please do.
And I'll focus on high school. Like I said, my high school was about 1,300 to 1,500 students each year. I don't think we ever had a year with more than 20 white people.
And it was in the Virginia area?
No, in Fulton County, Georgia.
Oh, okay. Thank you. That's okay. Thank you.
So, but the thing was that I would say, well, more than half of the teachers were white, and most of them were women. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the educational system, where you have these young white women who are 23, 24, 25, fresh out of college, mm-hmm. they've been miseducated through their lifetime. I don't think there's a lot of them haven't gone on that journey to figure out the world yet, but they're teaching. And now that I think about it, you have to look at both sides. You have these people teaching young white kids in that community and young Black kids in this community. They haven't been trained anything on Black culture, African-American culture, and what they have been trained on in their standard education about Black people. And I won't even say that. Let me rewind. What they've been trained in about American culture is skewed and inaccurate, because that's been tainted and a lot of the Black story has been removed from that. So it's kind of a thing of, now I know some white teachers that they really want to do good. They really want to help people. They really want to educate the children and make them have a successful future. Mm-hmm. But if you're not conscious of what you don't know, and you're not educating yourself on you know, even the psychological aspect of, okay, how do I deal with this culture that I'm not that familiar with? That's one thing. The other thing is, okay, well, the curriculum says this, but either I know that's not accurate or I don't know it's accurate. If I don't know it's accurate, that's a problem because I'm miseducated. If I do know it's inaccurate, what do I do? Do I teach the curriculum so they can pass this test, or do I teach the truth? Or, you know, it's basically all that is saying is the educational system and the education of the educators is a significant factor because they shape the views of a lot of children. Because like you said, a lot of parents don't talk about it, but it exists. They're getting things from television that's half true. They're getting things from school that's half true. And then we expect these people to come out and be a police officer.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah.
I remember a conversation I had with a woman in my neighborhood several years ago. Her dad was a principal when she was a girl. And he made a comment to her that just really stuck with me. He said, "Don't try and fix the system. It's too broken. You'll never fix this." And so again, it's like that reinforcement, white culture of it's hopeless, it's too broken, but yet, you know, that's a white voice talking. Now, actually, what I'm learning to say as a white woman is, no, the system works exactly as it's meant to. Right. It's meant to oppress. And we have been conditioned to get ourselves off the hook by saying it's broken. It is not broken. Right. We as white women need to stop saying that. I need to stop saying that. I've been conditioned to think that, and it's a lie. It's not true. And so that, you know, our hopelessness has been conditioned for a reason. Our passivity as white women, we've been conditioned this way for a reason. It's all intentional. It's not accidental. So let's just own all of that. This is all intentional. The educational system, the criminal justice system, every white system is exactly how it's meant to be, in a sense, of working for white people. So I need to own and catch myself, because I've been so conditioned to say that. I've been so conditioned to say everything's broken and it's hopeless.
All right. So I want to go back to something Tracy said. You mentioned, Tracy, that it's been the last 6 or 7 years that you've realized your role or how you truly feel about racism and your role in it. So I don't know your situation, whether you're married or single, but let's just put this in a family situation. Let's say we have this fictional person that's 45 years old, realized 5 years ago around age 40 that, hey, you know what? My view on the world is kind of wrong and maybe I've caused some damage. Maybe I am racist, or maybe I have racist tendencies. I want to fix it. But the person you married, your husband, is the same person that you met 20 years ago, and he's still who he is.
Yeah.
How do you make that change to say, I'm going to change my life in this direction, but your husband and maybe even your kids who've come up now and they'll say they're 15 years old.
Yeah.
All of them are still on the train that you're trying to get off of. What do you say to somebody in that situation? And this is open to both of you, but I'm just playing off of Tracy's realization of 6 years ago.
Yeah. Well, you're hitting on two topics I love to talk about. Relationships being one. I am divorced. I've been divorced about a decade. And what I've learned just about relationships in general, whether they're a partner, a spouse, close friends and family, I think that I'm a lifelong learner. And I just think what I've realized for myself is that people that are not willing to grow, evolve, expand, develop, be challenged are not people that I want in my inner circle. And I'm pretty firm about that. I've built my life around that because that's what we're here to do, is to learn and grow and evolve. So I would just say that. And that was a lesson that took me a little bit to get to in life, that's just really an important, important thing of mine. So I would say, to the extent, just for me personally, I don't really have people in my life that are in that camp. And I feel like most people, and when I say that, I mean like my inner core circle, most people are very willing and we're on this journey together and trying to evolve and grow. And so I would say for people out there that maybe are coming to a new realization that, you know, white privilege exists. And I've had many conversations over the last few weeks, been disappointed by these conversations, that a lot of people really are waking up to this. So I should be positive and happy about this, but it's frustrating too, because it's 2020. And I don't think there's really a lot of excuses to not understand the basics of white privilege and white supremacist systems. But having said that, I think if you are a person that does have close relationships that you feel like you have to pick, I think you better take a look at your values and really do some thinking about that. And I will share this too. The relationship thing I think is just I would encourage people to really think about their values. And if you're with someone that is not going to allow you to grow and evolve, then you are just as bad. You're probably worse than some of the people that we're seeing on TV with their knees on necks. You are a Karen in the extreme, and we all need to unpack our own bullcrap. We need to unpack this as white people, and we have to get proactive about it. It's past time. It's too late. A lot of us are too late to the party, but we got to get on the train. And yeah, so that's my little soapbox there. Sorry. But
I'm divorced as well. And I will say diplomatically, because this is for the sake of harmony with my ex-partner, we had different ways of talking about these things. I'll just be really diplomatic. And my way was not his way, and his way was not my way. And that was just really uncomfortable for me. And another layer of things as to why that relationship ended. But I think also one thing my divorce taught me is just how codependent I was. And I think a lot of white women have been, again, conditioned to be codependent. You look at codependency and traits of codependency, you look at white supremacy, it all goes hand in hand. So I own that. I appreciate that I, you know, can talk about that openly. I have no shame about that. I was raised to be very codependent and passive. So yep. Now that I'm self-aware about that, and I'm much more self-aware about, you know, how those qualities, you know, kind of bought right into white supremacy qualities. It's like this aha. Oh, of course. Yes. This all makes sense to me. And it's really helped me. Understanding my codependency has really helped me really honestly on my anti-racist journey, anti-racism journey. Yep. So I think a lot of white women are like me, and I would love to talk to them. I would love for them to contact me. I would love to have really honest conversation. I feel like my best contribution in all this is being authentic, being genuine, telling my story, talking about how I've learned, staying humble, and just having really heart-to-hearts and honest conversations with white women like myself. I think, you know, when you have any, I see racism as a sickness like alcoholism. And when you are sick with something, there's so much shame around that you don't talk about it, but we absolutely have to talk about our racism. It has to be part of conversation, period. And I want those conversations with white women. I welcome those conversations.
I feel like
I think too, like just to add, I totally agree with Sarah, to add to that, I don't think the average white person understands how racism has robbed us of so much too. Yeah, it's okay to look at what is happening to other people, but it has robbed us of a lot, and it's robbed us of a lot of our humanity. And so, yeah, and I think, you know, this is the problem where we protect ourselves. We don't want to step into it. We don't want to be humble. We don't want to own it. And we all just avoid it. And we are codependent with it, and we just avoid it. And that's why we're in the situation we're in. That's why we have the white supremacist structures and systems. And it's upon us white people to do our work to address pieces of that.
Glenn, may I ask you a question, or did you want to make a point? I know I want to make sure we cover what you need to.
Oh, go right ahead.
So in your outline, you talked about, and maybe I am projecting my own my own memory here. Glad if I am, I'm going to own it. But I thought, and maybe this is me and Tracy talking, because I talk about this all the time, something about our white women, like if white women own our shit, and I swore.
That's fine.
Like that's a huge thing. Like if we can do that, if we can own all this and talk about this and do our work, like I think that is a huge denominator and in this dismantling racism journey. Glenn, I'm humbly asking what you think about that comment. And if it wasn't on your outline, again, my apologies for my projection on that.
That wasn't on my outline, but I think we did kind of discuss it, I think, earlier. Okay. But yeah, so again, back to the being uncomfortable thing, I think it's kind of all the same. You know, if you can recognize that you're uncomfortable or wrong or racist or prejudiced or caring, once you recognize that, you have to make a decision. I'm going to continue being that, or I'm going to try to change that. Yep. If you want to try to change that, then I think is kind of where I was alluding to previously. I think the first thing is research. Mm-hmm. You have to start researching who you are, who we are as people of color. Mm-hmm. Unlearn what you've learned. So you have to recognize what you've been taught. You have to recognize that what you've been taught is incorrect, and then you have to go and find what is the accurate information.
Absolutely.
Once you've done all that, then you can go out and try to make change. Then you can go out and try to talk to other people and promote different causes. But to say, okay, today is Saturday, I'm not going to be racist anymore. So tomorrow I'm going to go out and try to get this policy passed or to try to campaign on this issue, that is dangerous and wrong. And I think that's what a lot of people are doing. And that's why a lot of us are upset about it, because some of these people that are pro Black Lives Matter and anti-police brutality, they just woke up last week. And what they imagined in their head is the right thing to do has been thought about, researched, and proven to be wrong, but they don't know it because they haven't done the research to find out that their thought is not the best way to handle this situation. So they're doing whatever they're doing and causing damage to the progressive push forward.
Yep.
So knowledge is power.
Yep. And I think white people struggle with that, because even I would say the people that I know that have very actively been on an anti-Karen journey, for lack of a better term, I think it's sometimes hard to know that. And we give ourselves a pass and we, you know, amplify voices from communities of color, bodies of culture. And sometimes it's a way for us to not take action. And sometimes it's the right thing. And I'm just mirroring what you're saying, that I do think in my circles, a lot of white people struggle with what to do, how to do, when to step in, when to not. And it's something that we do talk about in my white circles, definitely. So checking ourselves. How do we check ourselves? What's our real intention here?
So I would have to add to that. You can only do so much within your circle, because your circle has a lot of like-minded people. At some point, you need to pull some people of color into that circle to say, okay, are we right? Or what's your feel about this? You know, and no single or two or three people of color have the right answer, but they can at least kind of give you a clue that, you know what, that is completely not the right thing to do.
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the, so Resmaa Menakem, he's a teacher, author, trauma specialist, but he talks a lot about what the reason, kind of the trauma I talked about earlier, that one of the things that's problematic is we as white people, we don't have a container and a space to have these discussions and to process what we're learning. And too often white people, us Karens, we go to people of color and from bodies of culture and we ask them and we expect them to give us the answers all the time. And yeah, so I think it is. I absolutely hear your point. Like how and when is it appropriate for us as white people to seek the opinions and the advice? Well, and how do we know when we've done enough of our work, I think is something I'm just sharing that I think white people struggle with.
I think, you know, the perspective of a lot of people of color is that we don't, a lot of us may not want to be asked, is this right or is this wrong? Yes. You need to include us in the whole process. We need to become your friends. We need to become a part of your organization and a part of your club. And then you will just, one, you'll have that relationship. So if you do have a real question, you can go ask, because now you know each other. But secondarily, you will just, through your day-to-day actions, you will learn and there will be feedback and thought shared on a natural basis, and you'll get a better picture than just, okay, it's Friday, let me call my Black friend and ask them a question about this problem.
Absolutely.
I have.
Absolutely, Glenn. Yep. Yep.
All right. So, I don't know. There's a lot left to say, but you know, we don't have all day to talk about this. But I guess I'll maybe have one or two more points to touch on. And, you know, a lot of this for me comes back to the family. That's why a lot of my focus has been on mothers and teachers and the family dynamic. There was, I don't know if you watch Vice TV or Viceland. There was a show called Hate Thy Neighbor. So I don't know if you've seen that. There's a gentleman that goes around the world, but a lot of it was focused in the United States. And he would seek out racist people and interview them and say, hey, why are you racist? Why do you do this? Why do you dislike those people? You know, he interviewed grandmasters of the KKK and white supremacists and alt-right people. There was one episode where he was in some poor white neighborhood. I mean, either these people lived in a trailer or a house that was almost a trailer. And I don't say that to be insulting. I mean, that's literally where they lived, in a very torn down, raggedy house. And it was a married couple, and they had a child, like an infant. You could see that the husband was not quite as racist as the wife. The wife was all out, you know, people of color should die. White people should be the only people on the earth. That was where she was with it. The husband was like, yeah, I kind of don't like them, but, you know, they don't have to die, you know, that type of thing. And throughout the whole episode, the wife has the child, and she's just, you know, holding the child. And it was such a shocking and dramatic show because she's holding this baby the whole time. She's telling Blacks and Jews and Mexicans, they all need to just die. They all should just not live because my white child, and she's like literally stroking the baby's head, his future needs to be secured and all this other nonsense. So I said that to say that, and I'm not picking on white women, I'm not picking on women, you know, and I'm not saying that women have any particular role in society, but the reality is that children up to a certain age learn a lot from their mothers. That's male and female. You know, the first 5 or 6 years of your life, the majority of your time is probably with your mother. Even if the father's in the house, you know, mothers spend a lot of time with young children. So when you have situations like that, where you have a parent who is vehemently racist and just far to one extreme, what would you say to the, I don't even know how to address that. It's kind of a, there's really no way to insert yourself in that unless you are a social worker, police officer, some person with some authority to say, hey, you know, are you putting that child in a harmful situation, or are you mistreating the child? How is there any way that we could systematically maybe help those children not be under the influence of such? And it's not illegal. So that's the kind of rub. Like, there's nothing illegal about teaching your children to be racist, but we know it's wrong. Should we try to push for legislation that makes that a crime to teach your children?
Is it a hate crime?
Yeah, should we push for that? Make it a hate crime to make your children hateful? I don't know. Just a thought, how do we solve the problem before it becomes a problem?
I think I've heard a lot of people express the theory that people can have whatever attitudes they're going to have. But the issue is when they cross the line and they take an action that is impeding, hurting, taking away, impacting another person. Right. And it's interesting because I think about that a lot and I think, oh, that's interesting. But I think, I don't know, somehow I agree with your point though. I think that the attitudes are what drive behavior later in life. And I do, I think that's an interesting question. And I don't think the white woman that you're referencing, who clearly had strong opinions, I mean, again, I just want to kind of call it back that we as women, we all have that work to do. And maybe some of us aren't, you know, praising the KKK, but we all of us white women have that in us. We've been just culturally raised to see the world a little differently. And, you know, we all have to be unpacking our own attitudes and our own biases. And so I'm just kind of acknowledging that I don't think any of us are off the hook in this realm of fixing our attitudes and raising our children to, you know, to be on, to get on their journey early in life.
Yeah, one question, Glenn, talking about earlier in the conversation, talking about, you know, should white people just step back, you know, you know, and you're, to me, what I'm thinking in my right now is like, well, maybe that's a contribution we collectively as white women can make, that we collectively move for this legislature, that this is a hate crime. And we need to stop teaching our children these hateful behaviors. And this is violent behavior. And just riffing out loud, it's just, when you shared that story, that it's like, well, is this an appropriate action? You know, because my culture is perpetuating it. My culture is doing this. So is this an appropriate white woman action to fight for this type of legislation? It's just something I'm thinking about.
Well, yeah. You know, realistically, I mean, this is where we get into constitutional issues. You know, it would be great to make a bunch of different things hate crimes, but then there's this thing called the Constitution, right? Mm-hmm. So, right. And that's kind of why it's such a stress. There's nothing we can really do about it legally. I mean, unless we want a constitutional amendment that says racism are these 10 things, and if you do any of these 10 things, it's a hate crime. I mean, that's kind of the only solution, but then what about these other 12 things that aren't those 10 things that are still have the same effect? So it's kind of one of those things. It's just like, you know, there was a comedian who said, you know, I'd rather have racist where I know they're racist versus the racist where I don't know they're racist. Right, so right. On one level, it's like, well, you know, I hate that it's this way, but I'm glad I can see it. And I know I don't want to shop at this store because the owner's racist. I don't want to go to that church because the minister is racist. Or do we want people to just kind of go back in the shell, make all the money they're going to make, and take it and funnel it to these causes? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then there's the Constitution again. Anything we put in the Constitution can be used for or against us. Free speech works for us, and free speech pisses us off on a daily basis. So, you know, I don't really think it's reasonable to say that we'll make a hate crime law that says it's illegal to teach your children hate, but it would be a wonderful thing if we could do something like that.
What about something in the educational system, which we've all recognized is incredibly white supremacist, but, you know, looking at healthy behavior and you know, this anti-bullying campaign, and there's so much focus on. Now, when I was, you know, as like growing up, bullies were ran rampant, like.
Right.
And now there's all this energy on anti-bullying, and, you know, why isn't there more energy on anti-racism? Isn't that a clear form of bullying? I mean,
right.
And so having that as a major component in that curriculum, I mean, that to me seems like a step.
That sounds like a reasonable solution. That sounds like something that should be promoted as an idea.
So is that, you know, again, I'm just saying the question out loud. I'm not asking for either of you to answer it. Is that something white women can do? Is that a way that we can be helpful? Is that like supporting that, not dominating that, not controlling that, but like saying, we need this. This is important. We need, you know, people of color to, you know, I'll just stop talking, but it's just a question. Like, again, it just triggers like how can I, as dominant culture, like these NFL players who made a video and it mattered, you know, who can make this video who can make this video so it matters, is what I guess I'm asking.
Yeah. I think it's hard for white people to come in and... I just think I'm a real advocate. Our solutions need to be driven by the communities that are impacted by these things.
Absolutely.
You know, and so I think we as white women can support, amplify.
That's what I meant to say, Tracy. I didn't mean to say dominance. I said I'm not dominating this.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say.
But I do think that's something that we as white people, all of us white people, need to be mindful of, is that we are quick to jump to solutions and ideas. And,
absolutely.
And I, you didn't say that, Sarah, at all. I'm just saying that in general, I think we need to be humble and ask the people that are impacted by this what solutions they have, because those are the best solutions, and we need to get on board and amplify those voices and amplify those solutions and
absolutely
seek legislation around that. And one of my favorite things that I've read in the last year, it was an article in the, it was part of the 1619 series in the New York Times, and the title of this piece was something like, I'm not going to get the title exactly right, but democracy wasn't a democracy until Black Americans made it so. And that is so true. You know, the founding fathers wrote this great document with these great ideas, but they didn't live into those. They owned slaves. And, you know, there was a lot of complicated stuff. And the reason that we have anything resembling a democracy is primarily because of Black Americans in this country who have led the way and fought for those principles in that document. And so I actually take a lot of hope and a lot of, I find a lot of hope in the fact that I think that there's just amazing leaders. And so to the extent that we as white people can acknowledge that this has not been our shining glory and shining achievement, this democracy, as our country, I mean, we've made our contributions definitely, but I think that we can take a lot and learn a lot from some of the Black and people of color that are leading a lot of this work. Black Lives Matter, there's just so many. So, yeah.
I mean, to be honest, what you said is so true. Basically, every few generations, whether it be the Fair Housing Act, the Civil Rights Act, the Civil War,
voting rights, all
the way back, the Revolutionary War, everything that Black people have fought for and struggled for has benefited everybody even more than it benefits us.
Right, absolutely.
You know, so every single thing that we've died for, fought for, got water hosed for, gone to jail for, we benefit this much from, and mm-hmm. other people benefit that much from. So
right.
just looking at history alone, everybody should be on our side because everybody's going to win.
And, absolutely. You know, so
Native Americans have rights. I don't know the right word. Alternative lifestyle people have rights. Women, these things stem from
exactly.
Black people struggling.
Even when you look at Stonewall, I mean, Stonewall, the gay rights movement, that was a Black
right.
woman.
Right.
You know? And
the
so
Me Too movement as well.
Yeah, exactly. Me Too, exactly. It is. It's very encouraging.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think that's kind of a good note to leave that on. I guess I will open the floor for you two to have any final words or messaging that you want to get across.
Well, I can jump in. Thank you very much. This was a good conversation. And I just, again, am very humbled to be part of this discussion. And I hope that my hope is that we as a society and as a culture can kind of keep evolving, keep moving forward. But I hope that we can just step into having a little bit of cultural humility and be doing our own work and enlisting and engaging and working with others along the way. And despite all that's happening, I'm pessimistic, but overall I'm really optimistic. I feel like something has definitely shifted, and maybe it's because of COVID, maybe it's because of a combination of factors. But I think something's definitely shifted, and I'm feeling hopeful that we can kind of do better, because when we do better, when we can be better, we can do better. So I'm feeling hopeful.
I also can just thank you so much, Glenn, for this opportunity. It's very freeing to have conversations like this. I would love to have conversations like this minimally weekly. It's just, it allows us, you know, for myself as a recovering perfectionist, instead of being perfect, I can be real and authentic. And I see this humbly as a lifelong journey. It's the long game. It's part of like eat healthy, exercise, do my anti-racism work. Resma Menakem, is that my last name correctly? Yeah, I listened to a podcast you gave the other day, and something he said that really struck me is there is no failure, there's only practice. And it's just something I have in front of me reading it. So thank you.
Thank you. All right,
and thank each of you for joining us. And to my listeners and viewers, thank you for joining, and please join for another great episode. Have a great day. Thank you.